I'm Aaron Ross Powell, and this is Reimagining Liberty, a podcast exploring the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical social, political, and economic freedom. A lot of people seem pretty down on freedom right now. Some take it so far as to blame liberty and political liberalism for not just our economic woes, but also for allowing our culture to drift away from some kind of socially conservative, right-leaning, often religious imagined ideal. These post-liberals have found intellectual purchase, writing talked about books, headlining conferences, and catalyzing a new reactionary movement. But do their arguments work, or are they in fact self-defeating? My guest today is Michael Tolhurst, Senior Director of Research at the Institute for Humane Studies. Michael has graduate degrees in philosophy and political science, and today's conversation features a bit from both. We talk about the problems of post-liberalism and why so many are ready to throw away liberty to force their peculiar cultural preferences upon the rest of us. What does it mean to be a post-liberal?
I think that's a good question. I think, you know, if we sort of just look at the term, it means, I think, someone who sees themselves as somehow being past liberalism, that whatever that they have come up with in terms of their views has somehow answered questions that liberalism cannot, or somehow has given up on some of the key premises of liberalism. That said, I think it's kind of a murky term. It's not clear that it always means strictly anti-liberal, though I think a lot of people who describe themselves as post-liberals have anti-liberal views. And so I think it really is just kind of a catch-all term for people who, for whatever reason, see their views as somehow standing in contrast to liberalism and somehow coming past it or surpassing it.
Is it different then than just, I mean, you said it's not necessarily anti-liberalism, but is it just not liberalism? Because there's obviously lots of political theories that are non-liberal, that have been around and that predate liberalism, that were in competition with liberalism. The 20th century was a conflict, you know, violent conflicts between anti-liberal views. Is the post-liberalism we're seeing today just a return to communism, fascism, theocracy, whatever these things happen to be? Or is there something like a liberal DNA in it?
So when I use the term post-liberal, I try to use it largely as a descriptive term to try to capture all these people who are sort of coming up with illiberal or anti-liberal or, you know, these kind of surpassing liberal types of views, but without trying to sort of ascribe too much to them as to whether they see themselves as a particular school, partly because I think some of these figures are in flux, or you can sort of see their views sort of evolving as they are in conversation. So I think someone like Dreher, I think, is interesting, where, you know, in various of his blog posts, he seems to sort of have sympathy for, but then shy away from elements of national conservatism. He seems to have sympathy for, but then shy away from elements of integralism. So I don't know if it's clear yet that they're sort of solidified in kind of the amber of history to sort of ascribe to them a really sort of strict school or delineation. So that's why I think I sort of use the larger descriptive term. But you could say, I think, fairly, that are they participating in a certain sort of shared conversation space as a variety of historical critics of liberalism have? And I think that's absolutely true.
The thing that always strikes me, and I'm curious what your reaction to this, about a lot of the so-called post-liberals is how much of it seems to almost be an aesthetic movement versus a philosophical or an ideological movement. And so I think this is most prominent among the Catholic integralists, or is it integralists? I never know how to pronounce that.
I think I know a scholar who's coming out with a great book recently on the topic, so we'll have to ask him how to pronounce that.
We'll ask, yes. But with them, it is, they seem to be drawn to the iconography of Catholicism and the architecture of old Catholic towns and cities and the pageantry of it and this rejection of modernity as an aesthetic in a return to traditionalism. And so it almost seems like they just look around the world and find it aesthetically unpleasing and want to enforce. And I mean, that's, there's that specifically Catholic version of it, but that does seem to be like a broader thing, is we have, people are doing stuff that I find to be displeasing in this like reactive way, less so than, you know, liberalism worked out is this philosophy of institutions and rights and experimentation and knowledge acquisition and all of that. But so much of post-liberalism is just like, I don't like the modern world. And I imagine that if we could scale back liberalism, we could undo the modern world.
Right. I think the aesthetic element and sort of political thought tends to be pretty underrated. And I say that as someone who's like done, has a background both in analytic philosophy and political theory. And I and none of my sort of training do we talk a lot about the aesthetics. But when you look at even like historical movements, like fascism, right? And of course, this is a little bit easier for us looking back. You see the cultural elements, but you're sort of struck by the aesthetics of them. You know, very striking style, design elements that are instantly recognizable, such that it's sort of a meaningful thing to say that something has a fascist aesthetic. Or, you know, like sort of the Soviet realism of the 30s that has a particular aesthetic. And on the one hand, you could sort of take your sort of philosopher hat, your political theorist hat, and say, like, well, aesthetics is this just this kind of froth. It sort of sits separate from, like, the underlying ideology. But I think it certainly seems intertwined with how people sort of experience and understand their ideology and what they think there is that's good about the world. So I do think, like, the aesthetic element is a big part of this. I think the challenge then is how do you sort of take that seriously, because there's a way you could sort of say like, oh, it's just an aesthetic element, and say like, oh, then it's like not really serious ideas. It's like, well, these people, like folks seem fairly motivated by this. People seem very sort of distraught that the modern world appears ugly to them. You know, I think of something like, I don't know if I would call Prince Charles like a post-liberal, but, you know, he has a very famous speech in the 1980s sort of like decrying modern architecture. And like a lot of, I think, conservatives who have a preference for sort of classical architecture do find something sort of displeasing in the aesthetics. And that seems to matter. People seem to care about that. How does that connect into their critique of liberalism? It may just be that, look, liberalism is very permissive of different styles, or it may be a critique of, well, liberalism just sort of has an equilibrium where you go towards kind of a least common denominator aesthetics, which just they tend to find very displeasing. And so if you want to have like a more sort of refined vision, you have to somehow constrain society in various ways. That might be the thought. I want to be careful because there may be post-liberals out there listening to me speak, and even though I strongly disagree with them, I want to try to be as fair as possible in kind of characterizing the really baggy universe of views out there.
It seems that there are parallels here to a lot of contemporary Marxist critiques of, say, of capitalism, too, of it's this consumerism, mass production, forcing people into these meaningless pop culture trends to keep them engaged as buyers and not thinking about, you know, the status of the working class or their own oppression or alienation and so on. And it is striking how often a lot of national conservatism and this post-liberalism seems to have Marxist parallels. But the particular critique of liberalism that they raise, and this is, I'm drawing on an article that you published a while back in the online journal Liberal Currents, which I recommend all of our listeners check out, that they offer two kind of conflicting ways in your mind of framing liberal neutrality, because liberal neutrality is the crux of a lot of these complaints, namely that what liberalism says is we should, the role of the state is to protect our rights and let us get about the business of living our lives. And that one of the benefits of liberalism is that it allows pluralism. It allows us to go about living our lives in different ways while getting along with each other and mutually cooperating on important stuff. And you offer two kind of conflicting interpretations of this that I think are interesting, which is one that they object to neutrality because it means that they, the post-liberals, can't use the state to enforce whatever their preferences are because that's been carved off. Which seems, I mean, that one's very clear. But the one I'm really curious about is that the claim instead that the neutrality, liberal neutrality, is essentially fake, that it's a lie, that liberalism is not as neutral as it sets out to be.
Right. I think you sort of see versions of this in different sort of debate spaces, right? So you might say something like, what is it to have something like a public education in a liberal society, and sort of bracketing out, you know, your thoughts about what should be done or not done by the state. But like, let's say you have, like, liberal states do often have public education, you have that. There's going to be certain decisions about what that curriculum is going to be. And so if you say, like, look, the curriculum is going to maybe be more science-focused, maybe it's going to be more secular, it's not going to be denominational in focus, maybe we will not open the day with a prayer. I think to someone who sort of holds views that aren't sort of secular or non-denominational and has, you know, a very strong denominational identity, that probably doesn't feel necessarily neutral, or at least not neutral with regard to some of the things that they care about, right? Particularly if you understand, say, a religious position and a secular position to themselves be distinct positions, and rather than assuming secularism just is neutrality. And I think that probably comes into more tension as more people today probably self-consciously identify as being themselves either secular or non-religion. That idea of it being neutral probably doesn't sound as true anymore, I think, to someone who might be religious. Maybe that works if everybody in your society is religious, but all variety, like very varying different varieties of religion or denominations, and so the secular space is the neutral space between the religions, but it doesn't feel neutral if it's between a religious perspective and a non-religious perspective. So I think that's an example where they would say liberalism proposes itself to be a certain sort of neutrality, but it in fact sets the scale against a certain sort of neutrality. And I think that's actually sort of an interesting challenge in some ways. I don't think, let's just say I can understand why they would feel that way in this particular instance.
It smacks in some ways of critiques of, say, media bias, right? Like that. So a lot of people think the media is biased. But a lot of people think about it in the wrong way. And so they think, like, what media bias means is that the New York Times, the Washington Post are lying to you. They're publishing fake news and so on. And that's not how media bias actually works. Like, they reputable publications put a lot of effort into getting the facts right. But the way that media bias works, and so they see themselves then as, we are just presenting the facts in this, like, neutral way. But the media bias, the way it works, is in what they decide to, what facts they decide to report, what stories they decide to pay attention to, which ones they ignore, where they have their emphasis, and so on. And that seems very similar to what you're describing, at least in this case of, like, public education, is it's not necessarily that in a liberal society, the public schools are saying, your religion, your particular religion, is wrong. They're just not talking about it. They're downplaying it in favor of other things. And so there's a lack of neutrality there. Although that obviously, as in a pluralistic society, becomes a big problem to say, okay, well then, I mean, we can't teach every religion.
Right. So there's challenges as to, like, what the alternatives are. And this is a little bit, I think, of, like, sort of what I explore in the piece. Is this idea is, it's not clear, for example, that the Catholic school is necessarily neutral between the other religions in a way that they would perceive it as neutral.
But that, it almost seems like the answer to that isn't then post-liberalism in the, well, then let's pick a particular view and enforce it, but rather libertarianism. In a sense, like, the answer to the public school question is get rid of the public schools and is basically more liberalism in the sense of a baseline set of structures that enables people to pursue their own ends. And so that's vouchers or education tax credits, private schools, and so on, where the parents can choose, and then the people who want to send their kids to a secular school can, the people who want to send them to a religious school can. So why aren't, I guess, if the liberal neutrality critique holds, why aren't post-liberals libertarians?
Right. So I do think it is the case that some folks who might have issues with the neutrality question of public schools may be pushed into a libertarian position and say, like, hey, like, this is why we need school choice. This is why we need more pluralism. Let a thousand flowers bloom. I suspect what might motivate someone to be more post-liberal or illiberal rather than that kind of libertarian position might be a suspicion, perhaps not always like fully articulated, that such a regime or way of, you know, sort of setting out society may not actually be stable, right? That, in fact, there may be a suspicion that such a regime of pluralism might, in fact, actually devolve into conflict. And so maybe what is sort of hiding below the surface is this idea that you probably might want some sort of center to hold. Otherwise, all these sort of, you know, different kind of communities or views can't simply sort of float free peacefully in a pluralistic liberal society. That may be there. I don't know if I know of anybody who has explicitly stated it. But if you believe that to be true, that might be why you would be suspicious of that particular approach, you know, to a more pluralistic setup.
That does certainly seem to be implicit in a lot of critiques of liberalism and a lot of critiques of the current state of quote-unquote West, that you see many people making arguments about we're losing our Western values and our traditions, and these are what made us great compared to the rest of the world. And as we drift away from those traditional ways of being and institutions, we break down social ties and the family and virtue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that this then often manifests in kind of a reactionary, we need to return to traditional social hierarchies. I mean, this was, liberalism began as a rejection in opposition to conservatism, and the conservative arguments in Europe were often class-based. We need to maintain the aristocracy. It's what maintains order. The lower classes aren't really capable of governing themselves and are better off being controlled by the aristocracy, and the liberals were pushing back on that. And it seems like we see, I mean, in the U.S., we don't see an aristocracy-based argument, but we often see a, like, we need traditional gender roles, traditional families, male head of households. This turns into sometimes has it like a white nationalist angle to it of whites are the embodiment of the Western tradition and traditional values, and immigrant and ethnic groups are pushing back on it. Like, that does seem to be a pretty big part of a lot of this.
I think that's something that I've found very, very strange. I don't see myself as being particularly old or particularly wizened and sort of seeing several cycles of politics. But it is interesting because I would say, if you had asked me like 10 years ago, I would have said like conservatism in the U.S. is a type of, you know, right of center shaded liberalism. You know, if you think of someone who's like looking to the American founders and like the sort of the sort of genius of the American founding, and maybe they value things like decentralization, greater liberty. I see that all kind of within the liberal lane. What you're sort of talking about is really kind of an older style of European conservatism, and not in the kind of the Burkean vein, but someone like Joseph de Maistre, who is, you know, explicitly sort of arguing kind of in defense of monarchy and hierarchy, which is, I think, kind of unusual, at least in those kinds of terms, on the American scene. So I think this is a very strange. It feels recent. It may be something where someone who has studied this longer will say, like, no, this has always been kind of a subcurrent in American politics, American political thought. But this kind of turn towards sort of explicitly sort of like hierarchical, and not just sort of tradition in terms of like the American tradition, you know, enshrined in the Constitution, but sort of tradition as in a particular faith tradition in the way that like a lot of European conservatives argue, it feels very strange to the American context and feels very alien, which has this paradoxical thing, whereas that's not actually like the American tradition, really. So it is this kind of weird thing. It's like, if it's to be authentically a conservative traditionalism, surely the tradition that you should be adopting should be, you know, the tradition of the people or the place. But to sort of try to impose, you know, Hungarian architecture or something on America, you know, it just seems sort of strangely alien, given our story as, you know, people who've come from a variety of many different places and many different faith backgrounds.
I don't think it's entirely alien, though. I mean, the white-black hierarchy that existed, particularly during slavery and then in the early civil rights movement, is a version of this. You know, the Southern landed gentry with their plantations and the black slave class, and there were a lot of arguments that mirrored the aristocracy and lower classes of Europe, of the slaves need this structure that we're imposing, and so on and so forth. And so I think it showed up then, it showed up during the civil rights movement and the protests and separate but equal and so on. And I think to some extent we just need to distinguish, and I don't know that you can, but like conceptually I want to distinguish conservatism as a movement that did for quite a while have these liberal elements from just the right, which historically has had far less of that, and particularly the right as like a populist and non-elite movement had much more of the class consciousness and social status angle that's a big part of this. But it causes, I mean, it does cause a problem for arguing for liberalism, because if that's, as liberals, the way that we typically argue for liberalism is from there's like a moral side, which is rights are important, you should respect them, and also people being able to identify, like build their own identities, self-express, and so on is awesome. Like that's half of it. And then the other half is, oh, and also if you do this, we get great stuff, like it's a tremendous engine of wealth, which then has all of these positive, you know, both for the people who, like, it's great that you can earn wealth, but also your wealth creates positive externalities and it, you know, raises living standard, like, and it creates, it's more peaceful, so on and so forth. Like that's the argument. But if the objection to it is to basically accept all of that, but say it leads to a world that I'm not comfortable with for whatever reason, then that's a harder nut to crack as far as arguing versus, say, arguing like, you know, argue with a socialist who says, I think that, you know, workers are getting screwed. And you can say, well, I think actually like greater market forces can help the workers accomplish the things you're trying to. Like, that's a conversation you could have. But the, like, I just want everyone to have classical architecture and follow this particular faith, and I don't care about the rest of it, is like, it's harder to even know where to start.
Right, right. And I suspect, and it's a little bit hard not arguing from within the position, I would suspect the critique would also be something that what is most lacking is some sort of deeper meaning, right, that is somehow embedded and exemplified throughout society. So I think, you know, I don't know if liberals use the term beauty a lot, but these sort of, you know, traditionalists will often use the kind of the value loaded term beauty a lot. It's a little tricky, because if you're sort of not sort of within that perspective, it's hard to sort of like sort of sympathetically sort of put yourself into it and kind of see what the big thing is, you know. And so it does seem like, okay, like is it really just about the architecture? You know, is that really kind of what it boils down to? And I guess this is where sort of like liberalism is probably a position, and I'd actually be curious as to your thoughts on this, but I would suspect liberalism is probably going to, as a position, suggest that you're probably not going to find that deeper meaning in your politics, that that's probably not the sort of appropriate place to look for your deeper meaning. And this may be a fundamental sort of divide, I think, potentially with the liberals and the post-liberals, who sort of maybe see politics, if not a place for deeper meaning, certainly a place that can contribute or detract from the quest for a deeper meaning by how it shapes society. And I think the liberalists would probably just say, like, look, like, you know, you can find meaning, you will be free to find meaning, you should find meaning, But you're probably not going to find that in kind of your sort of political theory. I mean, does that seem like a fair characterization? Or
yes, I think that's absolutely correct. And I have made this argument a lot in the past that one of the problems with a robust politics, in the sense of a sphere of politics that determines a large extent of our lives or impacts a lot of our lives, is that it draws meaning into it, and it draws our attention into it, and that it's a corrupt way to be looking for meaning and belonging, because politics is always zero sum. It's always, if I get my way, you don't get yours. Whereas liberal tolerance is not zero sum. Like, if I get my way, you can also get yours. And so to some extent, given that there's never going to be uniform belief in both the sources of and kind of the contours of meaning, there's always going to be some conflict. If meaning comes through politics, you are getting your meaning at the expense of others and their ability to do so. And so I think it is actually, it's not just that there are, from a liberal perspective, better ways to find meaning in your life, but that I think it's actually, it is actually immoral to seek meaning in the political sphere, given what the political sphere represents. And it also, and we're seeing this right now with a lot of the Trumpist populism, is often you can find meaning like in religion, but if that's off the table for people, they often will turn to like nationalism, invest meaning in the nation. And then nationalism, as we well know, creates extraordinary problems, right, when people are like heavily invested in identity through the nation state, whether that's wars or genocides or just discrimination against people who come from other countries or other cultures and so on. Like, nationalism is incredibly corrosive and dangerous, but it does seem to be there is this weird notion that a lot of people have of like, we should find our meaning through the nation state and our politics. I mean, this is that the Trumpist nationalists do this, but so too, like, David Brooks is kind of constantly in columns calling for, you know, we need like renewed civic participation and things, you know.
I think nationalism, I sort of feel like it gets discussed on a spectrum where people sort of think like, we need like, you know, and I would say I see myself as liberal, and I think social connectedness is good. It's good to be connected to people in your life. But there's like, if you sort of consider that as kind of a continuum that you can kind of slide up and down, maybe somebody might say it's like, well, we need like maximal social connectedness, because that's like even better. And like, what does that look like? Well, that means everybody is sort of like connected to each other maximally at the level of the nation as part of some sort of like deep mystic bond of togetherness or something, right? And so I think that's where you sort of maybe see someone, like you said, like a Brooks, who might say like, well, like, I'm sort of reading about all these deaths of despair. People seem very disconnected. So it would be better if people were a little bit more connected. And it's like a pinch of nationalism from the cupboard, like a part of that, right? That's something that I don't know. You could put it like two different ways. You could sort of say like, look, nationalism is generally sort of often problematic, and so we should be very careful about sort of calling for the introduction of nationalism. Or it could sort of like translate what Brooks is saying something like, well, we just need a little bit of whatever that kind of togetherness stuff is. And he calls it nationalism. And then, you know, that seems like an interesting argument. I think it's hard to measure what sort of qualifies that sort of mystical togetherness. Oftentimes when you sort of see commentators talking about it, it does have this kind of like, I know it when I see it kind of nature to it. And so I'm not saying that it's, you know, like some sort of mistake to talk about it, but it's very hard, I think, to get your hands around what is actually meant, either in the sort of the kind of like the David Brooks, like we need more togetherness kind of approach, or, you know, again, what exactly the nationalists are talking about, other than that it would provide this sort of sense of connection and meaning.
I think that brings us to this other critique of liberalism that you see from the post-liberals, which is this like this shared, the problem with liberalism is there's no shared view of the good, is the argument. That the neutrality says everyone pursues their own view of the good, and but that can be, that's bad in a couple of senses. One, that there is something worthwhile in their view about a shared view of the good that makes it better than individual conceptions of the good and the good life. But the other one is that simply, if people are free to pursue their own views of the good, they're not going to pursue my view of the good. My view will be underrepresented based on my preferences. And this parallels an argument that conservatives often make about virtue, which is that what liberals or libertarians are willing, they place so much value on freedom that they downplay the importance of virtue. And what the conservatives are saying is virtue really matters. And if we have to trade off freedom in order to get more virtue, we're willing to do that. And then a Frank Meyer fusionist makes the argument that actually, like, the way that you cultivate virtue is through living free. It can't be forced upon you, but that also that libertarianism needs to be tempered with a conservative perspective so that you know what the virtues are. And that argument, or the argument about the good, has always struck me as kind of misplaced, because it assumes that essentially the liberal says, yeah, I don't have a conception of the good, or says, yeah, I don't value virtue as much as you do. And I think these other things are important, but I don't know that that's actually the case. And this is how, like, I would push back on the post-liberals, is I think that instead what the liberal says is, there, I do have a concept of the good. I do have a concept of virtue. It's simply different from yours. So for a liberal, like, the good as far as broader political life just is, the good life is a life where you are free to pursue your own self-authorship and celebrate the self-authorship of others. And living in a society that enables that is the good. And then on the virtue side, it's not that liberals say, oh, I think freedom is so important that I don't care about social connections or family or virtue or faith. It's that they're saying, no, I have different ways of, I have a family and I value family heavily. It just doesn't look like the kind of family that you think a family ought to look like. I am virtuous, but I think that toleration and celebration of diversity and autonomy are virtues, and they're virtues that you and your trading off of freedom don't seem to care about for whatever reason. Is that at least one way to answer some of this, the post-liberal critique, is to say, like, I guess you're damn right we have a conception of the good.
And that it places sort of a sort of allowance of people to choose kind of at the center, and an allowance of these different sort of forms, different institutions that sort of embody those visions to emerge, right? So you've got, you know, even in the early America, you know, many different sort of Christian denominations, and then later you get, you know, religions from other traditions also coming to the U.S. and sort of like living side by side. I think that is a case that liberals can make, that they say, like, look, I self-identify as a liberal, and my vision of the good involves this heavy portion of pluralism. I would sort of say, I would wonder if there's like many paths to being a liberal. So I think you could maybe say that, like, liberalism as like a sort of aspect of someone's identity. Like, I identify as a liberal, I support, you know, and by this, of course, I mean in kind of like the 19th century sort of freedom promoting sense, you know, as opposed to sort of the monarchist, you know, sense of the sort of liberal dichotomy, right? So, you know, I support, freedom and tolerance and pluralism, and I self-identify that and identify very strongly with those values. I think there may be ways that people could sort of maybe operationally be liberals, even if maybe they don't have an identity of liberals. And I think this was like a little bit of like what I was getting at my piece, where there may even be a case where someone might be operationally liberal, but actually hold illiberal views. And you sort of get there by saying that, you know, I would like have it in my ideal world that society could be structured according to my vision. I realize that is not obtainable. I realize I'm in a world where people do have a variety of different, strong, competing visions of what that should be. I think the sort of the pathway to my vision would be one of conflict that would sort of destroy the possibility for me and everybody else to sort of enjoy our visions of the good. And so I am going to sort of rest content with this situation as sort of a second best. So there, I think you could actually get someone who's kind of operationally quite liberal in the sense of pragmatically accepting tolerance. But they might not actually have, you know, sort of like a deep sort of a commitment to the good of tolerance in its of itself. And I guess we could have a question is like, you know, should liberals be worried if people are sort of like grudgingly operationally liberals in that sense? Is that something we should be worried about? But I do think that exists.
And that is one of the striking things about a lot of the, like the National Conservatism Conference and the, that I think it's happened twice now.
I don't know. I'm trying to remember if it got disrupted by COVID one of the years.
But were they, these post-liberals, conservative post-liberals gotten together and give their talks about how, you know, what's gone wrong with America and so on. And that this conflict that you're talking about, these multiple competing conceptions of the good, like you're absolutely right that it seems like the correct response to that is to say, is like the mutual disarmament of liberalism of, you know, like, yes, I can't, liberalism says I can't enforce my conception of the good, but at least I can live it. Whereas if we're going to enforce one, it might not be mine. And one of the odd things is how much the national conservatives and the integralists and so on don't seem aware of how unpopular their views are and how unlikely they are. So like Viktor Orban is this rising star in the American right in this very weird way. Like he's coming, I think, to CPAC.
CPAC is coming to him.
CPAC came to him, but I just saw there's some major conference that he's coming to speak at, and I can't remember which one it is.
At least the architecture will be good.
Yes, at least. But the idea that if we got rid of liberalism, Americans would embrace Catholic theocracy is deeply weird because not that many Americans are Catholics. Like it's just, and they're not going to choose that. And so you're going to lose out. It's going to much likely, like if it was going to be one, it would be like some form of Protestantism would be the American creed. And then these conferences have your Catholic integralists, your Josh Hollies, who are evangelical Protestants, your Hazonis, who are Jewish, like all saying we should get rid of liberalism. It's just bizarre to me.
Like, it doesn't seem like a practical program. Like,
it does not seem like a practical program in the slightest.
Like, if this is France and, you know, 1795, and you're hiding somewhere with some pretender to the throne, you're like, maybe we can get the monarchy back. You're like, seems like a long shot, but, you know, conceptually possible. Whereas you're saying, like, in this context, it almost feels like a little bit of like saying like we're going to get unicorns or something, right? It just seems very strange. Is that a fair way of?
Yeah. I think it's and there's what I wonder is how much of it is part of maybe an unstated like false consciousness argument, which false consciousness arguments are really common. People make them all the time. You know, like libertarians do this, where the reason that most Americans aren't on board with smashing the state is because public education has brainwashed them, or they're only getting their news from the liberal media and so on and so forth. And if we could just get like more Randian professors and get rid of the public schools, everyone would become an anarcho-capitalist is kind of the overstated version, but that's like a false consciousness argument, right? Like people have been tricked. And I think that with conservatism, with this kind of conservatism, there's also a strong false consciousness argument, which is that if people weren't having liberal cultural values constantly pushed and propagandized to them by Hollywood and public schools and so on, they would come to see the value of, they would recognize that their unhappiness is the result of turning away from traditions and conservative virtues and whatever, you know, the litany of their particular conception of the good. And so then they would suddenly all embrace this thing. Like the reason, so it's at like a very simple level, it is the reason that people that not many people disagree with me is because they've all been tricked versus they simply have other arguments or I haven't been terribly persuasive.
Yeah. I don't think they're necessarily, I think some of their views I find unusual and strange. I don't know if I would say that they are always impractical if your time frame is long enough, right? So you could, if you take their perspective, maybe they tell a story something like this. Maybe it's something like, look, America used to sort of have a particular sort of social structure, say in the 1950s, or pick your golden age, right? Whatever that might be. And maybe America was like more conservative around sexual issues, maybe more conservative in other areas. Maybe you sort of pull out some statistics that say more people went to church and you say like, okay, that's within living memory, right? That a lot of that has changed. So if you set your time frame at like 40 years, right? And you're just like really focused, maybe there's a bit of a false consciousness argument in there as well. Maybe there is something like where they do say that people are tricked, or maybe they're just going to say like, we're going to convince the new people. We're going to convince the younger generations. And that's why you have the memes out there, right? You know, trying to sort of rally a sort of energetic, you know, sort of cohort to kind of go out and kind of proselytize for this sort of vision. And maybe their thought is like, look, given enough time and kind of sort of the ideological equivalent of compound interest, right, maybe that pays dividends in 40 years. And do they have that kind of like longer time horizon? That might not be crazy. That might not be impractical, I think, from that perspective. I think there is, I think, the question you put out there is, are there particular parameters within which, you know, sort of like American history, American culture can sort of transform itself? And I think it would be hard to sort of like completely bend back kind of that sort of liberal individualism. I think that still is a factor on the right. I think it sort of reveals itself differently on the left. But I think it's that does seem to be something that's pretty baked in at this point into American culture. So I think it would be hard to, have a Catholic monarchy or something that would really sort of roll back that would be very difficult, I think.
Well, and I would also say even on that historical, like the 40-year time horizon thing, a lot of the view that, well, back in the 1950s, everyone was on board with this project, it depends upon ignoring a lot
sure.
of people.
Absolutely.
That the 50s... there were just a lot of voices that were not free to express themselves because of social pressures or even legal pressures. And so a lot of what looks like radically increasing diversity of viewpoints that we see today is instead viewpoints that existed but were not free to express themselves now being free to express themselves. And so that, I think, makes the project of turning back the clock even more difficult because
right.
it's less about persuading people back to beliefs, but instead saying, all of you who held these diverse views need to just kind of shut up again.
Right. I think that media environment has changed a lot. And I think it's actually, I think it would be quite challenging because on the one hand, the present kind of, you know, more fractured media environment makes it a lot easier for people to kind of sort of adopt or try to convince a few people of kind of unusual, you know, political beliefs that maybe we really need the restoration of the Stuart monarchy or something. You probably don't have many takers for that in a pre-internet age. But if I could try to like go and try to find, you know, Americans who believe that on the internet, I probably could, right? So like, I think the internet probably offers them a lot of like advantages in trying to win people over. But I think like you said, because of the way the communication technology is, like more, not just morally, is it sort of unjust to put, you know, ask people to not sort of, you know, speak their views on things. But just practically, like, I don't see how that could occur without, you know, like a very significant sort of censorship regime, which, you know, those have happened in the world and they've been terrible and awful and they still happen today. So hopefully that is not in our future. But absent that, I think it would be very hard to.
But it occurs to me as you're saying that, that very technology that has enabled, yes, like you to, if you're that one weird monarchist in your small town, prior to the internet, you're going to remain that one weird monarchist. But Reddit lets you find the / weird monarchist subreddit, and then you've got your community. But that same thing almost seems like it enables a particular answer or a particular solution to their concerns, which is that you can also create your own bubbles through this. So in the time of prior to the internet and prior to cable TV, when we had just the big three networks, there was this kind of, I mean, it wasn't a monoculture, right? But the main, like, if you wanted media, it came from a fewer sources and you got the broader perspective. But right now you can hyper custom tailor your media consumption habits and you can find outlets that come from the very narrow perspectives that you might like. And so you can almost build what we might call like a polycentric cultural order or something, you know, where the solution is liberalism politically, but then you can wall yourself off in this virtual world. And so like freedom of association becomes much easier and more robust in this world. You just have to be willing. And I think this is where a lot of the post-liberals would ultimately like disagree with what I'm arguing, is that you have to be willing to say, you have to be willing to be happy with it being your weird little bubble and there being other weird little bubbles that might occasionally intrude.
Certain projects are like clearly taken off the table. So like in the present world, if you want to hang out and talk about how awesome monarchy is with a bunch of other monarchists, you can do that. If you want an actually existing monarchy in America, that's kind of hard. You're that's not going to work. This is where I think with, and I sort of spoke a little bit in the article, kind of about Dreher, who is someone I've read off and on, and he seems to go through slightly different phases. And I think, you know, he would probably admit that he sort of changes his mind, which I think is actually quite a virtue of Dreher. Even though I sort of often disagree with a lot of his views, he does seem to really sort of grapple with a lot of new things and does seem to change his mind on occasion. But he had a previous position sort of represented by his book, The Benedict Option, where essentially my understanding is that his answer to this challenge was exactly something of what you propose, is that sort of religious conservatives could actually build thick communities oriented around a shared vision of the good, but that these would be at a level below the nation state, right? Now, again, there's this kind of like larger critique of society, and so you sort of need these, in his view, as kind of like life rafts or monasteries and a sea of, you know, sort of cultural flux. But that is perfectly consistent, you know, I think with like a liberal sort of frame. But he has since, I think, shifted and is gravitated much towards folks like Orban. And so I don't know fully why he made that shift, unless there's just some deep pessimism about the sort of sustainability of those sorts of intentional communities.
But it does seem like, to rephrase what you just said, the answer, if they can get over their hang-ups about other people doing different things and not being able to institute their preferred views at the political level, the answer is a Nozickian utopia of utopias. It is, you are free to associate and have whatever kind of community you want, as long as people have a right of exit, if they decide it's not for them. And then let the views compete in this marketplace of ideas. And if, I mean, people want to lead good lives. They want to pursue the good. They want to find meaning. And so if your particular conception of that is appealing or is good at providing those things, it doesn't need the state to enforce it. People will gravitate towards it, and people will embrace it, and that's great. Like those, you know, I don't want the particular like drear version of the traditional lifestyles, but I think it's awesome if certain people do and are happy in that.
I wonder if the conservatives might, or the sort of, I should say, more strictly, some of these post-liberals might wonder about that, because I think what you expressed there is a very sort of like market sort of thinking, and sort of like in the million sense, like you know, experiments in living, and that people will sort of, if someone is a post-liberal and has like a sort of a deep kind of sense of like human nature as somehow broken or somehow fallen, or you know, they may actually have like a lot of pessimism about the ability of people to make choices that make them happy. I don't think that's true. I am more on the optimist about human nature. But if you had such a pessimism about people's ability to make choices that make them happy, which doesn't seem like I could imagine people having experience that makes that belief seem true, right? Then maybe that kind of market equilibrium approach you spoke of, Aaron, might not be persuasive to them. Right, because they might say, like, look, people make bad choices all the time, you know, and we've got stories about it, like Adam and Eve, and like, however you interpret that, you know, literally, they'd say, like, but the story, the message, the lesson is there that people make poor choices. That I think shows like another potentially, like, I think with like a lot of these political debates, and I think this kind of came up in our conversation, as I do think a lot of the divides often sort of uncover sort of like almost like deeper disagreements about sort of human nature or like the structure of society that like people sometimes talk about, but like not always, but like you can always seem to kind of go like another level down and find another fundamental disagreement.
Thank you for listening to Reimagining Liberty. Here's a preview of the next episode, where I talk with journalist Radley Belko about criminal justice and why those demanding law and order keep mistaking violence and oppression for the rule of law.
The classic sort of example that I always see thrown at libertarians and conservatives when they complain about, you know, destruction of property as a means of protest is, you know, the Boston Tea Party, which of course we celebrate. But, you know, yeah, I mean, on the right and increasingly in libertarian circles, and particularly among the current incarnation of Libertarian Party, there is just this absolute kind of revulsion at letting Black people express their frustration about racism. And, you know, I mean, it's always kind of baffled me. And I guess I used to be part of this camp a little bit, the camp that kind of denied racism or thought or argued that racism wasn't a big deal. And then, of course, I started writing about these issues, and you see, you know, the issue of structural racism, which I think is widely misunderstood. Like, structural racism means everybody within a given system is racist. You know, you're accusing everyone of that. And of course, it's almost the opposite of that. It's that the intent of individuals in that system doesn't matter. You know, the system itself was constructed in an era when racism was sort of woven into the fabric of everyday life. And the idea that all of a sudden we can collectively decide that racism and Jim Crow are a bad thing, but still have these institutions that were developed and honed and evolved during, you know, the 100 or so years when Jim Crow was kind of dominant, you know, in huge parts of the country. Like, I think it's just really naive.
If you'd like to listen to my conversation with Radley 2 weeks early, as well as get access to our Discord community, where you can discuss episodes with me and fellow listeners and participate in our fun new book club, just click the link in the show notes to learn more, or head to reimaginingliberty.com/subscribe.